Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. It's Leighton Kling and Trent Kling with you today. A full show to talk about, including more earnings, as it is earnings season, but a couple of positive earnings this week, one from Five Below and another from Duluth Trading Company. And we'll talk about possible ripple effects from a rumored bankruptcy restructuring from Payless Shoe Source, and we'll discuss a much-rumored Sprouts acquisition by Albertsons. But we begin with a growing specialty retailer in Francesca's as they reported their fiscal fourth quarter and full year earnings on Tuesday. We begin by talking about who Francesca's is because we haven't discussed them prior to this point on the podcast. Francesca's is a specialty retailer, truly in the specialty space. Their focus is having a huge product mix, many of which are tailored to specific locations for which they operate. They're an interesting company in that they don't have a lot of standardized planograms for their store layout. So if you go to a store in one market, it's likely to look different, feel different, and have a different product mix than a store in a different location. They refer to themselves as a boutique. Their selection spans apparel, accessories, jewelry, and gifts. They keep very modest inventory levels to ensure an always changing assortment throughout the year and throughout the different seasons. They are improving on a faster inventory turn cadence, and that's something they mentioned in this earnings release, which we'll get to in a second. Their target demographic, women 18 to 35, so the much coveted millennial base that they're looking at here. Overall, their brick and mortar presence has 671 stores, and they have a very large and varied brick and mortar presence. Some of these are actually in indoor malls. We've talked about mall traffic levels falling. They're able to buck that trend. They're also in fashionable outdoor malls and larger markets, and they see runway growth of over 900 in the long term. We'll talk about their outlook here in a second, but first, Leighton, their fourth quarter results.
Yeah, and this is really an interesting retailer for a number of reasons. You mentioned their specialty nature. You mentioned the 671 stores. That's actually in 48 states, so they're spread relatively thin. To say they only have a runway for 900 stores long term, I think a lot of analysts have been shaking their heads asking why, if this retail concept is so successful thus far, why don't they have a longer runway? But with the financial results, we see the fourth quarter came in very positive for Francesca's. They seem most pleased with their rise in earnings per share. Earnings per share came in at 39 cents per diluted share, beating analyst expectations and, again, company expectations. The company was guiding for between 35 and 37 cents per share. Last year, earnings per share for the same period was 35 cents. Net income overall, $14.6 million, slightly down from the 14.7 they ticked on last year. 9.9% net margin for the quarter, 1% off of last year's net margin. Top line revenue increased 9%. That's the main figure we're going to be talking about as this retailer looks to expand. $146.3 million came in for the quarter, beating analyst expectations by about 0.5% and company expectations by approximately the same margin. Same store sales, the metric we always talk about, those were flat for the quarter, however, increased about 2% for the full year. They said that increased average transaction value was offset by lower transaction volume, so people are buying more at the register, but they have not been able to bring in an increasing store count overall. One bad spot that we pointed out for the quarter was the fact that gross profit, which for Francesca's is a function of both cost of goods sold and store occupancy costs, decreased to 46.4% of sales versus 49%. For the same period last year. Most of this negative effect was most likely due to the higher rent costs. Trent pointed out the target demographic for them trying to hit that millennial area. And so in order to really get those consumers, you have to be in the higher rent areas. And so I think that is costing them down the line. Selling, general, and administrative expenses came down as a percent of sales, despite having a little bit more corporate hiring and support due to their enlarged store count. They cited reasons for support being that they have now a very mature store base and they need to be able to act fast if a store needs assistance with something in terms of sourcing or otherwise.
And again, they had to support their enlarged store count in part because they are very spread out. You mentioned that they have a presence in 48 different states. And usually when you talk about a retailer that sees a little bit of space to grow in the U.S., they have a more regionalized base and then they grow out from there. But in this case, Francesca's pretty much blankets the United States. And so they feel like it's necessary to have that additional support staff. But it also should bode well for additional locations because they don't necessarily have to build out their distribution network at all. Now let's talk about their full year highlights as they did release full fiscal year 2016 numbers. Same store sales for the full year were up 2%, which is exceedingly rare right now in this marketplace for a primarily clothing-based retailer. Last year they were up 3%, so it's not like they were going against weak comps. They've shown steady growth over the course of the last 2 years. But where Francesca's really saw success was in their e-commerce platform, a massive 42% growth in e-commerce. So they're seeing growth in brick and mortar as well as e-commerce, which is a positive sign. And as we'll talk about later on in the show, those two numbers really work well together. Usually when you see brick and mortar growth and an increase in locations, you also see a bolstering in numbers of e-commerce. Further details from the company, and one of the things I liked about Francesca's overall earnings release is that they're very transparent in breaking down sales from product categories, but I think it shines a light on where they are functioning at their best. We've talked all throughout the course of the last 6 to 9 months about apparel and specifically women's apparel being an overall soft spot for the retail industry. With Francesca's, this is not the case. They saw a 14% increase in sales of apparel. It went, in fact, up as a percentage of overall sales, too. You saw them sell $53 million worth of apparel during fiscal year 2015. That number has increased to over $60 million in fiscal year 2016, which, like I mentioned, accounts for a 14% increase, which outpaced increases in just about every other category besides jewelry. And it's not just a function of them opening up more stores. They are selling more apparel on a store-by-store basis, which, again, is rare for a women's apparel retailer. We talked on last week's show about Christopher & Banks and how we were worried that they were falling out of favorability in terms of fashion and in terms of style. And Francesca's really drove home the idea that they controlled inventory levels so they can turn over inventory rapidly. And that seems to be adding to their top line sales in women's apparel, where a business like Christopher & Banks is having a hard time keeping up, not only with appropriate inventory levels, but also with fashionability. As we mentioned, sales increases in jewelry and accessories as well, something of note for Francesca's. The only area where they saw a decline in terms of overall sales was in the gifts category. It went from about $26.6 million 1 year ago to $25.8 million this year, a very slight decline of about 3%, but that was more than offset by increases in other categories. And of course, they have what they call an others category as well that saw a massive amount of increase. Overall, top line sales were up 9%. And if you go quarter by quarter, every quarter during fiscal year 2016, they saw comparable store sales that were either flat or significantly in the positive, peaking in the third quarter with a 7% same-store sales increase. We talked about the fiscal year same-store sales going up 2% as compared to 3% in fiscal year 2015. It is amazing that they were able to maintain flat or positive same-store sales during the last two quarters of fiscal year 2016 because they were going against very tough comps, 4% in quarter three of last year and 11% of quarter four of last year. They did see a number of expansions, but also some closures as well. As Layton mentioned, their real estate holdings are largely in concentrated areas where they know that 18 to 35 demographic with expendable income will either be residing or shopping. So they have to try and maintain that store count in fashionable areas. They opened 64 stores during the last fiscal year. They closed 9 for a net new store count of 55. So they're up just in the last 2 years by nearly 150 stores. And as Layton mentioned, they see an increasing runway to growth. And this is something we don't often see for a boutique clothing, handbag, and jewelry retailer. Usually the story we're telling about these retailers, especially when they're based in malls, is a negative one.
And I think the growth prospects overall are a little bit modest for the company. So if they increase by 230 stores, that pretty much maxes them out. They see that as a mature stance in the current economy in the United States, having 900 stores. Also, I think it's a bit impressive that same-store sales were up despite some of the increased pressure in what they called the cold weather regions. They said those sales were a little bit soft for this last quarter. They did, however, see the southern stores, the stores that were in the warmest parts of the country during the last few months, do really well. So that is a strong suit. It wasn't to say that they were blaming the cold weather regions at all. They were basically being able to still squeeze out positive growth despite having lower than expected sales. You spoke of their product assortment, Trent. That's something I wanted to touch on briefly. Their handbags were the standout with accessories. The accessories have three subcategories: hats, sunglasses, and handbags. And then boots and tops were the strongest area in the apparel segment. You mentioned some slight softness with the gift category, and I think that's due to the fact that if you go to their website, the gift category is actually the last tab on the main page. You see that apparel's number one, followed by jewelry and accessories. So it's kind of in the background there. I think it's more of a function of those brick and mortar stores. I think that's where you're going to see the curated selection of gifts, some localized gifts there at the brick and mortar locations. But overall, they spoke of having that curated selection create a high-touch merchandising environment where customers will actually have an advantage in shopping in the brick and mortar locations over shopping online. I think that's where that gift segment comes into play. And they said that many of their products cannot be found through competitors' e-commerce websites because they use many smaller companies to source their products. We're talking again about local companies, companies that may not sell on Amazon or a larger e-commerce competitor. So I think right here is where they have the advantage. We speak of the competitive nature with their niche, but I think this is where they are really going to outlast the competition, because having that high touch environment means that you're having gifts and other things, accessories that people can try on and see the sizing for themselves and not go based off of what a metric says on the e-commerce site. So I think that's going to be an upside for them in the long run. And they said that this also creates an aura of scarcity with their merchandise. So for instance, if you only have a gift that only has three on the shelf, you may think that this is a limited time offering and that buying it now would be the best thing for you. And again, that really ties into what you were talking about with their inventory turns. If you have a lower level of inventory, that helps out the store overall, that gives them a little bit of agility with sourcing and buying for the long run or for the effects of seasonality. That being said, their website is really good and really well put together, in my opinion. They have the appropriate sizing data laid out in a logical way, and they also have these subcategories and search tools laid out very well as well. So I think there's a lot of positive nature surrounding their website, and that is why I really wasn't surprised to see over a 40% boost in their e-commerce sales. They have openly expressed the need for more marketing, however, as marketing dollars did increase for the full year fiscal 2016. They most likely will be looking to increase those in 2017 as they grow out that store count. You see television ads increasing in areas that are new to them. So I think that's an essential part of their business, and then also social media, something we touch on all the time. With their strong or now strong e-commerce presence, it's going to be a very important feature, a very important asset for the company to spend marketing dollars in social media.
And part of the social media presence they have includes a strong YouTube account. They're using it in a similar fashion as Ulta, although not specifically like Ulta. What they're doing with their promotional videos is truly special in that they're not just trying to sell their products, but they're overall almost trying to sell a Francesca's lifestyle, if you will. And part of that is the localization of each one of the stores. They give store managers so much leeway in terms of even individualized product sourcing for that region and the ability to work with local suppliers. So that bolsters out the unique feeling you get in a boutique like Francesca's. And like you said, Layton, it almost Amazon-proofs the business, because by bringing in these local suppliers that may not have national distribution deals, It gives them the ability to talk to their customers about how going to Francesca's truly is a special and unique experience. It's not like going to a Target or a Walmart, or even on the other side of that, it's not like going to a department chain or even a store like, you know, Christopher and Banks, like we talked about, or The Gap or Old Navy, any one of those things. They are in their own specific segment. And it's not unlike what we talked about with West Elm, in that they are very careful about where they're opening stores, and they give those local stores a lot of leeway. So there are no standardized plans necessarily for each individual store, how they have things laid out, where they have things laid out. And it's crucial too that their product mix changes region by region. They talked about strength on a region by region basis, especially with the southern region. Part of that is because they understand the regionality of things within their business. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like, Leighton, you and I both like this concept as a boutique. And even though people and analysts are a little bit critical of the fact that they're not expanding quicker, especially given the success that they've seen, I think their expansion has been managed to a point where they're aware of where they can go. They're aware of the real estate holdings or the real estate areas that they need to be located. And I'm fine with their current plans of expansion. One final note here regarding their share price. Shares initially popped by over $1.50 per share in after-hours trading following this earnings release, but quickly subsided. Now they're trading just 2% higher where they were pre-earnings announcement. They're around $6.20 per share. So that $1.50 per share was a significant pop for the company, nearly 25%. Overall, they are a smaller cap retailer. They have a $611 million market cap with a modest price-to-earnings ratio of about 14.5, which suggests that maybe the market doesn't see a large runway to growth, but certainly from the outside looking in, it seems like Francesca's has the ability to grow out their e-commerce platform and also grow out their brick and mortar platform. I wouldn't say they're as mature as their price to earnings ratio indicates quite yet.
Yeah, and reading through their earnings transcript, you can definitely see that the company intends on growing out their brick and mortar presence. They said that some new point of sale systems that are going to be rolled out in 2017 is going to capture some consumer data, their core customer data. They estimate that they only know about 5 to 10% about who their customer base is right now. So it's amazing to this point that they've been able to open up in locations successfully and really attain those core customers that they're eyeing. They've been doing very well at targeting those key demographics despite not exactly knowing where those customers are coming from. And I think that plays into their second big initiative for 2017, which is a test of a new loyalty program. We move into our second story with Five Below earnings, as they reported fourth quarter results after the market closed on Wednesday, beating expectations and causing the stock to pop nearly 10% in after hours trading. Founded in 2002 and headquartered in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, they reported earnings of 90 cents per share, beating expectations of 89 cents. During the fourth quarter last year, they reported earnings of 77 cents per share. So you can see a big pop there on the earnings per share side of things. Top line revenue came in at a whopping $388.1 million, beating the Thomson Reuters consensus forecast of $387.6 million. This was an increase too of about 19% year over year. So not only are they more profitable, they're bringing in more customers overall. Full year 2016 revenue hit the $1 billion mark, which was a milestone for the company and represented a 20% increase year over year compared to fiscal 2015 revenue. Operating income also increased at a 23% rate, a higher rate than revenue, showing again efficiencies within Five Below and really knowing their core customer base in order to source the correct merchandise. Same store sales as a result climbed 1% for the quarter versus expectations of just 0.9%. We expected to see a little bit of a larger increase, Trent, as we had talked about their last earnings report, because during the same period last year, they yielded a very strong 3.6% increase on the same store sales side. Still, same store sales have increased for 11 straight years for the company, indicating how the company has grown over the years and how they're still on track to beat their own company expectations.
Overall, for the year, same store sales were up 2%. They had even stronger same store sales earlier in the year, although this is a retailer that tends very heavily towards the fourth quarter in terms of top-line revenue, but also in terms of their net income. If you look at their net income for the entire fiscal year, nearly 60% of it came from the fourth quarter alone. So they're relatively stagnant in the first three quarters of the year in terms of overall income. And then they really pop in the fourth quarter as they see a massive increase in business, particularly around gift giving time towards the end of the year. And that is part of their overall concept. They've really hit the stocking stuffer aspect of their business hard during this past year, as they've done in years past, and it did pay off for them. They're concluding cash and cash equivalents, which we've been looking at more and more as some retailers are having liquidity issues. Solid signs here for Five Below. They have $76 million in cash and cash equivalents on hand, and that's versus $53 million last year. So you see a $23 million increase, which is solid, especially considering that they are still opening a number of new stores. They opened 85 total new stores for the full fiscal year. They entered four new states and new markets as well, including the ever-growing Rio Grande Valley market, which should be a strong play for this retailer. They now have over 500 stores in 31 states. We'll talk about their full year outlook in a little bit, but first, to kind of recap Five Below, and not only their merchandise concept, because I feel like many people listening to this podcast probably knows the overall merchandising concept of a Five Below, where everything is $5 or less. But I think the way in which they differentiate themselves from a typical dollar store, and you see sometimes earnings from Dollar General or Dollar Tree affecting share price of Five Below and affecting how the industry looks at Five Below. Five Below is honestly a unique retailer, in part because of where their stores are located in comparison to where other successful retailers are located. And to recap this, I don't want to assume everyone's been listening to the podcast for the last 6 months straight or the last year straight, but Five Below holds a lot of real estate in the same strip mall or in the same shopping complex as the likes of a TJ Maxx or a Marshalls or an Ulta. Those are businesses that we've talked about having a massive amount of success over the last 18 months, and they are reaping at Five Below some of that success, and they are piggybacking off of some of that success. Likewise, you could say the same of the other retailers piggybacking off of Five Below. So you see them outside of areas where you would typically see a Dollar General or a Dollar Tree. We talked during last week's show about the fact that Dollar General has a lot of holdings in rural areas. Dollar Tree has a lot of holdings in areas surrounding a Walmart and those real estate strip malls there. So very different concept overall for Five Below, in that not only do they restrict prices $5 and below, but it gives them a little bit more flexibility in terms of product offering too. They're able to offer more licensed products. And when you see things like team licensed apparel and team licensed merchandise, especially in markets with an NFL or NBA team, we see strength in those particular units. And Leighton, some of the things that Joel Anderson mentioned during this earnings call were some of the product classifications. And he mentioned that they were seeing a number of areas of growth throughout their product classifications. But one of the things I liked about Joel Anderson is he started right off the bat by discussing kind of implicitly the idea that retail is struggling. He said there are some retailers out there that are winning. And he said, and I quote, in many cases, they have a differentiated concept and they offer value, end quote. And that's something that Five Below is able to deliver on both counts. But one of the things that not many people talk about with Five Below that differentiates them from other dollar stores is that they have an excellent e-commerce site as well.
Absolutely. And you can see those different product classifications on their website. They're separated by style, room, sports, tech, crafts, party, candy, and what they call now, which is where they put their seasonal product offerings. And they call these worlds. So CEO Joel Anderson actually calls these worlds. They don't call these product categories. So everything about Five Below is a little bit differentiated overall, which is exactly what he said. That is their intent, is to be a little bit different than the other dollar stores and to target those younger demographics who are coming into those other stores that have been so successful as of late. Right now, if you look on their website, fivebelow.com has some of their featured products on the front page of their website, and they include a $5 virtual reality headset, a t-shirt, Bluetooth headphones, a tub of slime, and Easter kits. So just a wide variety of offerings, again, tailored towards the younger demographics and some kids. But right now, you see that their product offerings really have to create a wow factor. This is what the CEO calls it. He called it this many times throughout their earnings presentation. So he really wants to be able to have customers come into the store and be wowed by the merchandise, the seasonal merchandise they have on the shelves. And they said one of the strategies they're using is to make purchases to their suppliers a little bit quicker. They want to get ahead of the ball. And by doing this, they're going to see increases in these category sales. They said since they've been on top of the Easter sales, they've already seen increases in those categories year over year. And so this is a really good sign for a company knowing who their customer is. It looks as though they're learning from prior years and really executing well going forward. On Jim Cramer's website, he had commented on some of their product assortment and says that a lot of it is Amazon proof. And an analyst had said, where else can you buy a tub of slime? And I think this is a very good point to make when you're talking about Five Below, because they honestly think outside the box. They're a different retailer. Again, they're not just a typical dollar store. And to be honest, if you're an Amazon, you have to be a little bit weary, because we talked about this with Francesca's. You have that appeal where you can come in and touch the merchandise, feel the merchandise, and see the merchandise firsthand. And I think that's what they're really taking away from the Amazons of the world. Not only that, you have a cheaper price point. So perhaps you would be able to buy some of these items on some popular e-commerce websites, Walmart.com, but you're gonna have to pay shipping for it if you're not a Prime member, or if you don't get that free shipping at $35 or more with Walmart.com. So I think this is going to be something that they're always going to have going forward. And again, management spoke multiple times about innovating in order to keep a fresh look and customers' intrigue. So they're aware that they are a niche in the market, but they are also aware that customers need to keep coming in to see what's interesting and what's new on the store shelves.
And as we wrap up our look at Five Below, Five Below has become aware of an increase in use of YouTube, and so they're using it and other on-demand video platforms to advertise connected products. For example, they're advertising a $5 virtual reality headset with their own YouTube video. They mentioned also conventional TV advertising will be used, especially in markets that are new to Five Below as they continue their expansion. Regarding their e-commerce site, they're looking to enhance their e-commerce site, which Leighton and I have already talked about. It still works pretty well overall. They did what they called a soft launch in August of last year. Overall, they mentioned that the results have been positive and they're looking to expand delivery of certain items nationwide in 2017. But they wrapped up this earnings call by talking about the investment in their people. They stated that they've hired in nearly every functional category for the firm over the course of the last year: human resources, planning, marketing, and so forth. This type of hiring is, of course, normal with a growing firm, but they recognize the need to continue to grow as Five Below expands throughout the country. Again, started in Philadelphia, what once was a Northeastern regional retailer is now a nationwide retailer. And they have an emphasis because of that in increased training, not only with the company policies and the branding of the company, but also to strengthen their employee teams, prepare them for increased growth in the future. As we mentioned before, shares did pop of Five Below in after-hours trading, and they continued the momentum into normal trading hours on Thursday because this earnings release came late on Wednesday, March 22nd. Shares were up over $4 a share, or around 12%, hitting a three-month high of right around $43 per share. When you look at the stock for the year, it's basically flat, but down from an all-time high it achieved in the summer of last year at around $52 per share. We talked about the price-to-earnings ratio of Francesca's not indicating that the market sees a lot of growth potential. The market sees a modest amount of growth potential in Five Below. Their current price-to-earnings ratio is around 31 on a market cap of $2.3 billion. And one last note on Five Below before we move to our next story. We talked about their increases in comparable store sales. They have room to grow in terms of traffic, as they didn't see much of an increase in store traffic, but that increase in same-store sales was due largely to ticket size, as they're doing a better job of getting people to splurge on impulse buys right around the point of checkout, and they've increased the number of products as you go through kind of the serpentine setup of their lines in their brick-and-mortar concept.
And then lastly, we have the full year outlook for the firm, with full year expectations a bit better than expected on the earnings per share side and the top line revenue side. Top line revenue, for its part, will be projected to come in between $1.21 billion and $1.23 billion, which is an increase, obviously, of between 21 and 23%. They are expanding. You talk about shareholders, maybe a little bit optimistic about their growth. They expect to open 100 new stores, which would increase their overall store count by about 20%, but mostly in existing markets. So a common theme here that management had talked about was brand awareness. They think that if they can penetrate a market or get into a market where they already have existing stores, they can leverage that brand awareness and get those same store sales up. Some might think they would have an opposite effect by doing so, because if you have too many stores in a certain market, you could cannibalize your older stores. But they called this retail densification and a strategy to boost, again, brand awareness overall. And they spoke of the huge opportunity in some newer markets, however, one being California. They said they're going to enter for the first time there with 9 new stores in the greater LA area.
We finish our first block of the Retail Focus podcast by talking about another upstart retailer that had significant success. This retailer, though, started in the e-commerce realm, and they've gradually built out their brick-and-mortar presence, kind of the opposite of what Five Below has done. We're talking about Duluth Trading Company, as they released earnings earlier this week, beat most analyst expectations with their earnings, as well as their overall fiscal year 2016 results, which they released along with their fourth quarter earnings. As referenced a few shows ago, their stock had fallen precipitously since their last earnings release back in December. It fell from $37 on December 8th to at one point in March below $18. They've averaged around $18.90 per share in the trailing 3 weeks prior to this earnings release. And this is something that kind of caught our eye, as we were wondering why and if there were any underlying issues with Duluth Trading Company. Nothing had come across our radar, certainly, as we followed the company pretty carefully. There was no reason, it seemed like, for the sell-off or the decline in price on the market. We felt like it was an overall reflection of retail and how people are reacting to many negative headlines regarding retail. Their price-to-earnings ratio had fallen to under 32, which is rare for a company that has talked before about wanting to grow out their store count in a massive way. But on to the results, where in quarter four, they showcased top-line revenue of $174.7 million. To compare this to the previous year, it was over a $34 million increase from $140 million in 2015. That's percentage basis, a 24% increase. And it also topped analysts' expectations by over $11 million, or 7.2%. That's not the only area they topped analyst expectations. They also topped analyst expectations in earnings per share by 32.5%. This suggests that maybe analysts didn't buy the company guidance, which was a little bit closer to reality, and maybe analysts were perhaps misled by that overall perceived softness in apparel and retail overall that we just discussed. The increase in top-line revenue was driven equally by jumps in their e-commerce or direct-to-consumer sales. They saw a 15% increase in that category year over year in the fourth quarter. But they also saw massive growth in their rapidly growing brick-and-mortar segment. They had built 7 new stores by the time the fourth quarter ended in 2016 versus the end of the fourth quarter in 2015. And that showed, as they saw a 106% increase year over year in retail sales. This suggests that not only are the new stores doing well in terms of sales, but the old stores are seeing positive comp growth as well. Now, they don't give same store sales or comparable store sales numbers just yet, because they have too small of a sample size with which to do so. After all, they only have 9 stores that have been open at least a year by the time their fourth quarter ended. If you want to look at an area that might have fallen a little bit short, at least compared to last year, it might be earnings per share, at least on a year-over-year perspective. Their earnings per share of 43 cents, though, still beat analyst expectations, as I just mentioned, by over 30%. Analyst expectations were 34 cents earnings per share. However, their fiscal year fourth quarter earnings per share were $0.58. Let's talk a little bit about why this is, why they saw a decrease in their bottom line numbers. The company converted from an S corporation to a C corporation. And when you do that and you're the size of Duluth Trading Company, you usually see a little bump up in income taxes, and they did. Income taxes for the company increased by $6.5 million. So if you added that $6.5 million to their bottom line number of $14 million to try and normalize the difference between the 2 years, things do look pretty good in comparison. It indicates about a $3 million year-over-year increase if we try to normalize the numbers due to them becoming a C corporation from an S corporation. That's about 63 cents per share on an earnings per share basis. But again, their actual numbers, their GAAP numbers were 43 cents. And I credit the company, although they pointed this out, they didn't blame this or try to produce any non-GAAP numbers for it. And we're usually loath to just write off special expenditures related to business recalibration. But in this case, obviously, it's important to do to try and normalize those numbers. We talked about the fact that they didn't release same-store sales metrics. However, they did mention gross margin, which declined slightly from 56.1% to 55.4% due to promotions to drive traffic, particularly in the e-commerce realm, Layton. And we've talked before about how e-commerce retailers really have to keep up with promotions, as depending on the research firm you use, about 60 to 80% of e-commerce sales in the last quarter of 2016 took place on promotion.
Yeah, and what's astounding is they were actually able to grow brick and mortar sales alone by 76%. So this really says that the promotion they're doing with their e-commerce really does translate to growth in their brick and mortar too, which is something, a certain dynamic that we'll get into a little bit later. But overall for the company, you see a very strong company that's operating at a very high level, beating those expectations. Gross margin remains steady for the firm as well, 56.9% versus the 57% they had last year. Net income did fall 22% to $21.3 million as a result of the aforementioned tax charges. Trent, you covered that very well. They also had some other one-time charges, but what is interesting about this company is they don't report those on a non-GAAP basis. They include everything in the final numbers, so we can respect that from at least our standpoint. And they chose additionally to not blame weather for shortcomings, and we saw this with Francesca's, and we see this with a lot of other retailers that are basically calling out the retailers that are saying that effects of seasonality, when we talk about bad weather conditions, can hurt a business, but it's up to the business to really relate that to their overall performance and say that despite bad performance, we were able to come up and do well on an individual store basis. And that's exactly what the CEO had said. So this pretty much calls out any other apparel retailers or specialty apparel retailers that use weather as a long-term excuse or even a short-term excuse. And if you look overall in the next year, fiscal year 2017, they're opening a lot of stores, Trent, almost doubling their current store count. They expect to open 10 to 12 new stores, two of which have already opened for fiscal year or calendar year 2017. Additionally, as we had mentioned with Dick's Sporting Goods last week, they believe that the brick and mortar presence boosts the e-commerce sales in those particular markets. Again, something we have talked about, which really lends itself to the fact that they cannot be shy when entering into a new market. They have such a massive presence. When you're talking about big advertisements during the Super Bowl weekend and things of that nature, if you open into a market that you're not familiar with, it isn't necessarily like stepping into an unfamiliar territory. A lot of customers have been well acquainted with their website, again, a very well put together website. And so when a new store opens, there's already this aura of optimism around it. And I think that's really what you get when you read through the earnings transcript here. There's a very distinct possibility that they actually outdo these projected store openings for 2017, as the current stores have been performing very well. As I mentioned, brick and mortar sales alone growing 76%. It's an astounding figure for a company who's relatively new in their respective industry.
Coming into 2016, or the last fiscal year, they mentioned that they might open 4 to 5 new stores, and they opened 7. Right now, they have 9 leases signed beyond the 2 stores they've opened. So at the very least, they should be able to open 11 stores. And it would not be surprising to see 1 or 2 more store leases come together before the fourth quarter of fiscal year 2017. And as you mentioned, Layton, they're not shy on the marketing efforts. I mentioned during Food Focus, I had an opportunity to go to the Kansas City metro area this last week on business. Duluth Trading Company opened up a new brick and mortar store in Independence, Missouri, which is the Kansas City Metro, back in the fourth quarter of 2016. And there was traditional signage everywhere on billboards. They're doing a lot of traditional advertising, trying to reach out to people and say, hey, you know our commercials, you know our e-commerce site, come visit the brick and mortar, the real thing there. And going to that particular store, it was pretty busy. It was pretty crowded while I was in there to visit one of their brick and mortar locations. But to me, the most positive sign is this: the fact that they have a cash balance currently of $24 million and net working capital of $66.1 million. But at the same time, as they're opening all of these stores and putting forth all of these new capital expenditures, they have no borrowings on their $40 million revolving line of credit, which is pretty rare for a retailer that's in a growth phase like this. And I feel like this speaks to the quick repayment of store opening costs. Back early in 2016, the company had remarked that opening costs were paid back relatively quickly for each individual store. Usually you're looking at a 12 to 18 month time frame. We don't know if that's exactly still the case because, again, they didn't mention it in this latest earnings release, but it sure looks so when you look at the overall cash on hand. We talk about liquidity being so important for retailers, especially ones that are in growth phases. A couple of quick notes on their outlook for this next fiscal year. They expect net sales to be around $455 to $465 million. Keep in mind that for this last fiscal year, it was $376 million. So they see an increase of about 15 to 20% at least. They want to add around 120 to 144,000 square feet in store sales square footage in the brick and mortar realm. So that comes out to around 12 to 15,000 square feet per each new store that they open. And they expect earnings per share to be around 66 to 71 cents on a per share basis. And again, when you compare that to numbers from this last fiscal year, those compare favorably, and they seem to indicate an increase, although not a massive increase, because they do say that they will be making quite a number of capital expenditures. They're looking at $31 to $35 million of capital expenditures, most of those tied up in the opening of new brick and mortar stores. So when you watch their stock and look at their stock, there's a very real possibility, and we've discussed it before, that they're undervalued as far as a retailer is concerned. They're a great example of why e-commerce retailers need to maintain a brick and mortar presence. And many people, when they first started to open brick and mortar stores rapidly a couple of years ago, they were critical of the fact that Duluth Trading Company was doing this, noting the fact that people were increasingly shopping online and noting softness in brick and mortar retailers. However, they've proven that to be truly omnichannel is to have brick and mortar presence. And when we look at other profitable retailers that began primarily as e-commerce retailers or gained popularity as e-commerce retailers and later built out a brick and mortar presence, you look at someone like Moose Jaw, which we talked about on the show last month. They got bought out by Walmart for a reported $51 million. Warby Parker is another retailer having a massive amount of success in the eyewear industry. He started as largely an e-commerce retailer, and now they're jumping into the brick and mortar realm. There's a great article this week by Forbes writer Stephen Dennis about the general unprofitability of most e-commerce businesses. And I think it's easy to forget about this when you see all of the news headlines about how brick and mortar and department stores are struggling and malls are struggling and everyone's shopping online now. People forget that brick and mortar retailers, for the most part, are still pretty profitable. That's something that we've talked about in the past, people glossing over with JCPenney. They look at department stores as largely failures, but JCPenney in their most profitable quarter in nearly 7 years during their last quarter, And it's because when you have that brick and mortar set, you can increase overall sales because you are truly an omni-channel retailer, but you have another phase there through which you can drive sales. And many customers, as Leighton mentioned during the last segment, they still want to get out to the stores. People still want to experience the brick and mortar. They want to touch, feel products, that type of thing. And Duluth is banking on that because they are an apparel retailer. They're hoping that they can get people in the stores. They can get people to try on their products, feel the quality of their products, and grow it out more from there. But the gist of this article written by Stephen Dennis was the fact that many e-commerce sales rely on promotion. We talked about anywhere between 60 to 80% during the final 3 months of 2016, it's estimated. Many models, because of this, are inherently unprofitable. And he is worried that many venture capital firms will never see a return on investment. And that's something Duluth is trying to buck by growing out their brick and mortar presence. We talk about Walmart's acquisition of ModCloth on a previous episode. It's rumored that the price will be between $50 and $75 million there. That's actually less than the overall venture capital investment, which was $58 million, according to the website TechCrunch. So in effect, they're throwing a bunch of money at these e-commerce sites, but the e-commerce sites fail to oftentimes see profitability, or if they do see profitability, it's not by very much. After all, when you look at a company like Amazon, their price to earnings ratio is 173. And in part because Amazon's okay with lax profitability in exchange for overall market share. But a small cap e-commerce retailer, the likes of, say, a Duluth, they don't have that flexibility. But when you look at what Duluth has done over the past couple of years on a strict bottom line profit margin basis, Duluth actually has a higher margin than Amazon, around 9% in fiscal year 2016 versus 1.74% for Amazon during that same time frame. So you like where Duluth is headed with their brick and mortar set. And because they started out as primarily an e-commerce retailer, they're able to integrate more of these omni-channel experiences for the end user. And because of that, you can see more profitability in their future.
You mentioned Warby Parker being a good example of another e-commerce first retailer that has delved into brick and mortar, and we spoke about them not too long ago, expanding their brick and mortar presence into some larger metropolitan areas on the West Coast. And I think that is a perfect example of a company that has done a very good job leveraging social media to get customers drawn into their website. But then when you talk about their expansion into brick and mortar, Warby Parker says that they've really differentiated by customer service, that human interaction that people get when they come into the stores, and the ability to try on glasses there, even though they offer some very good promotional activity with it, trying on glasses and then returning them via their website. I think there is something to be said for that brick and mortar presence. And you had mentioned the VC investment there with ModCloth. I think there has been a lot of venture capital money that has been thrown away because someone comes up with a very good idea for an e-commerce website that just does not pan out. With Duluth, you see a very good marketing campaign surrounding the company that has been bringing in customers to their website, but they're also able to leverage very high level of merchandising in their brick and mortar stores to also interest people in coming to their shops. And as you mentioned, very high volume. You go into their individual stores. It's some very good signs for Duluth, and the payback period is very similar to that of Five Below. You talk about 12 to 18 months. Right now, Five Below's payback period sits at about 12 to 13 months, and they have the same net margin. So if you have a net margin between 9 and 10%, at the end of the day, why not enter brick and mortar?
We begin the next segment of the Retail Focus podcast by turning our eyes towards the rumor mill. And in our first story, we'll look towards the grocery sector, where rumors abound surrounding Sprouts Farmers Market. They're said to be in preliminary talks to potentially be acquired by longtime grocery staple Albertsons and be taken into the private sector. Shares of Sprouts are up more than 25% since trailing early last week, but were up just slightly after Bloomberg first reported the story.
Bloomberg was actually the first to get on these preliminary talks, and the talks between the two companies are said to be in the beginning stages. But for the two companies, it is interesting because within Albertsons, you have a very large retailer, number two in terms of a actual grocer in the United States in terms of store count, number two to the number one Kroger. And then with Sprouts, you have an up-and-coming retailer that really is like a natural grocer's that prides themselves on having a very organic or natural selection of foods and organic produce. But Sprouts has grown to about 260 stores in 14 states. So that may seem like a small number, but not that long ago, they had 17% less stores. So in 2015 to 2017, they've grown their store count by over 50. So that's a lot of new open stores for Sprouts. And I'm sure that they've been looked at as a very attractive acquisition for these larger grocers. And I think that's namely because they are a profitable one. Sprouts last reported on February 23rd, where they had their full year results and fourth quarter earnings. They indicated a 13% sales growth year over year, and net income for the full year was $124 million, as they reported full year same store sales of 2.7%. Both of these numbers are in line with something that an Albertsons would love to have in their portfolio. Albertsons, for their part, is actually a privately owned grocer. And you look at their store portfolio, Trent, they have 16 different banners. They have Shaw's, Pavilions, Amigos, and then, of course, Albertsons. They're owned by Cerberus Capital, and they're just a massive operator in nearly all 50 states. So you have to wonder, why are they looking at Sprouts as an attractive acquisition? Well, namely, Sprouts has been doing a very good job at campaigning and getting these customers coming through the door. They're having a lot of promotional activity. They're kind of an off-priced retailer in that fact that they're known for their very aggressive pricing and their frequent promotional pricing. So I think this is going to be something that does differentiate them down the line between the likes of Whole Foods and natural grocers. We've spoken about how Whole Foods has been increasing their pricing activity. They said that between every week, week to week, they have between 1,000 and 2,000 promotions at Whole Foods. And to be honest, Sprouts does a way better job in communicating this to their core customer. I think that's one of the reasons Albertsons is finding this to be attractive. I think overall, you see their previous acquisitions of Safeway for $9.2 billion. They're not afraid of spending money for grocers that are up and coming.
That's right. And this is very similar to what we talked about this time last year when the Fresh Market was rumored to be in talks to be purchased by a number of different companies. The only difference here is that Sprouts is profitable. In fact, you look at their earnings, they have positive earnings per share on an annualized basis of 83 cents per share. And as we've talked about, their share price has gone up since scuttlebutt of this first started taking place. But Albertsons is not immune to growing through acquisition. And I think honestly, Leighton, we've been probably lax in mentioning how much Albertsons, just like Kroger, grows through acquisition. We've talked so much about Kroger surging through acquisition and acquired brands, but Albertsons has done the same thing of late, most particularly with Safeway, of course, at the beginning of last year and taking them private as well. You mentioned marketing in Sprouts, but this would give Albertsons an additional holding in the natural food space, which I think is as important as anything now, especially since many Albertsons stores and many Safeway stores aren't quite as big as your Kroger Marketplace stores. And so they have to have some way to be able to capitalize on the burgeoning natural and whole foods market. And perhaps they see Sprouts as a potential in this area. We could argue, of course, about personal feelings regarding Sprouts versus natural grocers versus Whole Foods versus all the other competitors in this space. But the bottom line is Sprouts is expanded. Sprouts is profitable. They're finding a way to make things work. Their current market cap is over $3 billion. And, you know, Sprouts honestly has quite a bit of leverage in this deal. I think shareholders would be upset if there isn't a significant premium over the current share price paid, considering that the price to earnings ratio for a growth centric company right now for Sprouts is pretty modest at 27. And that's after all of the share price increases. It sat much lower than that earlier in the week. And honestly, especially considering the shrink back we've seen from Whole Foods and their willingness to close certain underperforming locations, you can see perhaps room for expansion for Sprouts as people begin to tire of Whole Foods and we see traffic numbers begin to fall back there.
Yeah, and I think overall you're able to see a company within Sprouts that's an attractive acquisition because of that current market cap. You mentioned just over $3.15 billion. I think overall, if you have a company in Albertsons who's owned by a parent company who has more than that in cash on the balance sheet, you look at the trailing 52 weeks for Sprouts stock price, they are actually down 21% despite the recent bump due to the rumor of this acquisition. So I think it is going to be targeted, if not by Albertsons, potentially another grocery who's grown by acquisition in Kroger. They've been growing a lot, especially acquiring smaller grocers on the East Coast. And I think that Sprouts really does fit into their niche in trying to have a larger organic and natural food selection. So as you mentioned, a very important facet for a company here that has been marketing to millennials with those health conscious consumers in mind. And I think there's going to be a lot of positives if both of these companies can come together for the long term. Our last story for this edition of the Retail Focus will be a quick one. Again, Payless shoe stores likely closing many stores. And we have to ask the question, who stands to benefit? The Topeka, Kansas-based retailer is reorganizing in bankruptcy. And yesterday it was reported by Fortune that they would in fact close up to 500 stores. Let's be mindful that they haven't yet filed for bankruptcy protection, but that part is likely to occur as soon as next week. We've talked about this bankruptcy earlier in the year as it was a rumor, but at the time it was unclear of how the organization would be executed. We talked about a lot of analysts targeting the number of stores they might be able to close, and how Payless over the last couple of years has transitioned from a retailer that has been shy about entering into new mall spaces and a little bit different as far as their strategy and how big their stores should be. So something that they've been looking at quarter over quarter to try to really simplify their store mechanisms and then also implement some deep e-commerce changes as well.
Yeah, according to a report by Bloomberg News, it was citing unnamed sources, of course, but Payless may close, they said, as many as 500 stores, as Leighton mentioned, but had considered closing as many as 1,000. And one particular source said the number may still be subject to change, but this is a much smaller chunk of stores than was originally rumored, since they do overall operate 4,000 stores in total. But we want to get kind of to the speculative part of the story here. Anytime a retailer closes a large amount of stores when they're reorganizing in bankruptcy, and it's not a planned reorganization like what we saw from JCPenney earlier this year, someone stands to benefit. So this slew of store closures or rumored store closures from Payless shoe stores might put other shoe retailers in a positive position, because Payless does operate in a number of small to mid-sized markets. As Leighton mentioned, they're trying to standardize their square footage, so it might be some of the stores in small to mid-sized markets that are getting cut. And a company could, in theory, come in, swoop in, take over leases, or take over markets left without a significant shoe retailer. And so as we were kind of looking around certain shoe retailers and other retailers that kind of fit in this space, one retailer that already has growth plans in the pipeline really stood out as potentially standing to benefit. We're looking at a retailer called Shoe Sensation. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Shoe Sensation, they first opened in 1984. They're headquartered in Jeffersonville, Indiana. They had 149 locations at the end of calendar year 2016, but that number is steadily growing. They have holdings in 18 states. Most of them are Midwestern states. However, they want at least 175 locations by the end of 2017, and they want these locations in primarily small to mid-sized markets. Their overall store count already increased by 25% in 2016, including taking over some leases from operators who exited markets, including Shoe Department, which is owned by Shoe Show, a much larger company that operates over 1,000 shoe stores throughout the United States. Because Shoe Sensation has seen the most growth during a period in time when their e-commerce site was being built alongside their brick and mortar growth, they've seen most of their growth basically in the last 7 to 8 years. They've been able to offer a number of different omnichannel benefits that other similarly sized retailers haven't yet figured out. And I wanted to take this opportunity to kind of compare and contrast the retailers that might indeed benefit from the possible Payless store closures. Now, when you look at Payless as an example, they do offer free returns to any Payless store. But when you click the link on their website, now this speaks to the operationality of their website. And this is something Leighton and I have talked about when discussing these bankruptcy rumors before. It actually just sends a visitor to a generic women's shoe link. So you can't find any information about their system regarding free returns to any Payless store or even their free shipping promotions. And there's no buy online and pick up in store option at Payless when you go through the shopping cart for an individual shoe. We talked about Shoe Show just a little bit earlier. Shoe Show and Shoe Department, meanwhile, seem to have processing delays on many of their products on their website, which is never a good sign. We saw that hurt Restoration Hardware last year. They don't have buy online, pick up in store options or buy online and return in store options, which brings us to Shoe Sensations website, where they have both buy online, pick up in store options and buy online, return in store options available. And when we talk about their expansion to a lot of these small and mid-sized markets, the ability to send a product to a store and have someone pick it up there or have them return to the store there is absolutely crucial, because in these small to mid-sized markets, shipping is not always made easy through UPS or FedEx, especially with those in rural areas surrounding these small to mid-sized markets. So this might actually benefit Shoe Sensation, and they may see positive numbers where Payless just wasn't seeing the numbers in those same markets.
And along with those companies, you have a company in Shoe Carnival, which is actually another brick and mortar shoe retailer in this space that has a very large presence inside the United States, as they just reported their fourth quarter earnings. They actually reported a loss for the fiscal fourth quarter, a loss of $920,000, whereas just this time last year, they recorded a profit for the same period. This represented a loss of about 5 cents per share on the adjusted earnings per share basis side of things. Overall, you have a retailer here that brings in over $1 billion in revenue on an annualized basis. But Trent, this is an industry that really has been getting hit hard from the emergence of these e-commerce retailers. And to have a good omni-channel platform is a necessity. And with Shoe Carnival, you see their website has a little bit to be desired. You don't have a great of capabilities you have with some of these other websites, especially the ones you were talking about with Shoe Show or Shoe Sensation. So I think that right now, as it stands, Shoe Carnival could learn a lot from these websites that are doing a very excellent job in promoting their products. But to have that capability, particularly with shoes, is extremely important. I myself am a runner, and anytime I buy a specialty shoe online, I need to be able to have the comfort in knowing that I can return that shoe within a proper time frame. So if something's not right with either the sizing or the fit of the shoe overall, or how it runs with me, it's something that I really tend to want and see through a retailer. Even if they're giving some steep promotions, I need to be able to have that safeguard. And this is something that Dick's Sporting Goods, which has emerged as one of the leaders in this space, has promised through their website. They're able to return a lot of these products in their stores. And I think that's something that Payless Shoe Source should really be looking at. They look to transition out of these financial woes.
Shoe Carnival, another business, although they're a larger square footage business, and I'm not sure they stand to benefit at least from Payless exiting in terms of real estate, they do not offer buy online and pick up in store as well. And you talk about the usability of their website. Now, I do have their investor relations website bookmarked, but if you try and find their investor relation website by clicking links through the site, when you click the link to their corporate site, it actually takes you to a store locator. So I feel like that speaks well to the lack of usability on their website.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we finish up the Retail Focus by each looking ahead towards one story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. And Leighton, I understand you're here to tell us about something Mr. Lampert's way.
Yes. So Sears had made a statement to the SEC earlier in the week. It was actually on Wednesday as they saw their shares drop about 12%. A statement that said, and I quote, "Our historical operating results indicate substantial doubt exists related to the company's ability to continue as a going concern." And this, again, was a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Due to this statement here, this really is in contrast to everything they've been saying through their last earnings releases. You see that they always highlight positive things, positive signs for the company and how management sees them going forward. They have outlined a very strict cost-cutting measure that actually has included store closings throughout fiscal 2017. However, despite cutting costs, they think that they really are not a viable company going forward. However, after this statement, CFO Jason Hollar reiterated the efforts of the company, highlighted those cost-cutting efforts, and said that Sears remains focused on executing our transformation plan and will continue to take actions to help ensure our competitiveness and ability to continue to meet our financial obligations. And those financial obligations, Trent, are very deep with Eddie Lampert, as Eddie Lampert owns the majority of the company's debt through ESL Investments. So in my opinion, if you're an investor with this company or an analyst, I would strictly be looking at those GAAP reports, not the non-GAAP statements that the company is making outside of any secure releases. So overall, I think this is a company that if you're in it for the long term, you would need to see some sort of transition for the company, some results that would reflect a true change that really we have not been seeing up to this point, either it be their membership program or their same store sales. Both of those have not come out with positive results.
And Eddie Lampert, of course, so many years ago came out denouncing same store sales as a metric. You know, turns out it's kind of important to have positive same store sales at your outlets. But you mentioned if you're an investor, making sure to look at just GAAP-based reports and not all these hopeful statements. It seems like the stock has popped historically about 5 to 10% every time Eddie Lampert says, hey, things are going to be fine, or hey, we're turning things around. But as we've talked about before, you can cut costs through closing stores, but you're also cutting revenue sources and you're cutting your ability to purchase based on economy of scale with your suppliers. My looking ahead story has to do with Restoration Hardware. They were a business that was seeing a few struggles during the beginning of last year on the supply chain end of things. They released their earnings on March 28th, and they go against very weak comps for last year's second quarter. Can Restoration Hardware continue their momentum as indicated by the previous quarter's results? The market seems to think so, as their stock has bumped up past $37 today and currently has a price-to-earnings ratio of about 52. Most of this optimism lies in that their second quarter fiscal year 2017 results can't possibly be as bad as their second quarter fiscal year 2016 results, where they showed negative GAAP earnings per share of 5 cents against estimates of positive 5 cents there. So they actually lost money in the previous year's quarter. I think you're going to see certainly positive results from Restoration Hardware, but I'm curious to see exactly how positive, as they are still limping somewhat from that about 6 to 9 month hindrance in sales they experienced during the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016.
Yeah, and like Kmart and Sears, they also have a membership card that was rolled out and faced a lot of criticism initially. It was rolled out in March of 2016. It's called the RH Gray Card, and for $100, you can get 25% off any furniture at a Restoration Hardware. And they said that that's actually been a very positive sign for the company and that they've been able to boost traffic levels. But overall, you see that really cutting into the bottom line, if you have 25% off all merchandise and if you have some buyers or contractors that make frequent purchases on Restoration Hardware's website, that will eat into sales long term. However, if they're able to keep those margins up, that will be a positive sign for the company as we look ahead for their future earnings results.
And we talked about that system basically as a method to increase traffic, increase repeat visits by customers, and also increase kind of front-end top-line revenue, because there is a cost to that membership program, but we were wondering about potential long-term costs. However, for this quarter, it will include a number of renewals on that, so that's one reason why there's some positivity surrounding this potential earnings release, as many people are renewing their membership to this program for which they are charged during this past quarter. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I am Trent. Check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast for all the week's retail news in between the episodes. And we'll be right back on the air next week with a food focus earlier in the week and a retail focus later in the week. Plenty to talk about on each. It should be a good time.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.